Welcome to the Applied Materials conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, you will be invited to participate in a question-and-answer session. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Michael Sullivan, Vice President of Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. Today, Applied Materials is excited to be bringing you some important new technology to the semiconductor industry. Today's call is designed to give you more details, also to give you a chance to ask some related questions later. This call is not going to be financial in nature. Joining me this morning is Kevin Marais, and he's a Vice President in Applied Semiconductor Products Group. Before we begin, please know that you can find a copy of today's presentation on the landing page of our IR website at appliedmaterials.com. We'd encourage you to read the Safe Harbor passage on page two so that we don't have to. Also on the website are animations that we've created to help you visualize how the new technology works. So what you'll see today is 2D. If you click on the website, you'll see the process flow and you'll see how everything works in detail. Before we begin, I'd like to make a calendar announcement. On Tuesday morning, July the 10th, Applied will be hosting an investor breakfast at the Yerba Buena Center in San Francisco. That'll begin at 8 o'clock in the morning. After the breakfast, we would like to ask you to stay with us for the AI Design Forum. This is a major industry event that will feature world experts in artificial intelligence, systems architecture, chip design, and semiconductor process technology. The event is going to be the first to outline the future of computing all the way from materials on the wafer to systems. The event is being held in conjunction with SEMI and SEMICON West, and it will run from about 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. After that, it will be immediately followed by the Bulls and Bears panel. You'll be getting some invitation information in the near future, and feel free, of course, to reach out to Applied Materials team. So with that, I would like to turn the call over to Kevin Marais.
Thank you, Mike. Hello, everybody. This is Kevin Marais. I want to thank everybody for attending today's presentation. So I am Kevin Marais. I'm the Vice President for Product Management in our Metal Deposition and Packaging Business Group. This is within our Semiconductor Products Group. Just as a way of introduction, I've been with Applied since about 2000, and I've been with the Metals Group since about 2004. Today, we're really excited to be announcing a major change in our transistor contact and interconnect metal roadmap. We're actually introducing a complete suite of products for the fabrication of transistor contacts and interconnects using, for the first time, the metal cobalt. And just to give you some perspective, this is the first time in over 20 years that a new metal wiring scheme to connect billions of transistors is being used or is being announced. And the last change was the early adoption of copper in 1997. And this is another example of some innovative material engineering work that Applied Materials is doing to enable the fabrication of high-performance chips to power the AI era. So before we start, this presentation includes some forward-looking statements, and we have a brief disclosure here that you should be aware of. As Mike mentioned, this is also posted in the presentation. So with that introduction, I'm going to start the presentation just with one high-level slide to put this all in perspective and provide some context for our excitement about the semiconductor industry. So we are actually sitting at the cusp of the biggest computing wave yet as we enter the AI era driven by big data. This, of course, builds on the huge expansion in the market during the mobile era driven by social media, and previously the personal computer and the internet era. And actually, we are in the early innings of the era of AI and big data, and we expect the need for significant enhancement in performance for both processors as well as the capacity and latency of memory required to enable this new wave. So moving to page number four. Just as we are needing this performance for these big data applications, AI applications, we start to see that classical Moore's law has been slowing down. On the chart over here is a chart put together by John Hennessy and David Patterson. And you can see the performance, although there's been a huge improvement in performance over the years, the rate of performance gains have been slowing down as we reach the limits of Dennard scaling in critical areas. We've seen the limits of parallelism be reached, and we're now just seeing a general slowdown in the performance gains every year. By the way, if you're curious or interested in more about this, David Patterson is going to be a guest at the Applied Materials AI Forum on July 10th that Mike mentioned earlier. So moving to slide number five. Just another couple slides on the overall framework. In the PC era, we actually saw a very few number of materials that were integrated, and primarily using lithography scaling, there was a significant improvements in performance gains that were achieved. However, these performance gains have been slowing down, and the cost efficiency of these performance gains have been reducing as customers have had to deploy schemes such as a self-aligned double patterning and self-aligned quadruple patterning, as well as EUV, to continue litho scaling. In addition, the industry has made many architectural changes, for example, going from planar to FinFET, that have improved performance. However, the biggest change you'll see is in the materials. So in the early 90s and 2000s, there were very few a set of materials that were used in semiconductor manufacturing. By the year 2000s, as we enter the mobile area, the number of materials have increased. In fact, Applied also introduced the cobalt encapsulation product back then, as well as, of course, high-k metal gate had been adopted by that time as well. But what we see the biggest change really up in the near future, where you're going to see a significant increase in the number of materials used, and likely the adoption of many exotic materials required to deliver the performance gains that are going to be required for this AI era. So I want to add one more slide to underline, and this is on slide number six, one more slide to underline what's different in what we are presenting today. As I previously described in the PC era one, this was characterized by classic Moore's law shrink and easy to integrate a few number of materials to improve gains. And the gains are typically described in terms of the chip performance, power, area, and cost, commonly referred to as PPAC. These could often be done with single process systems. In era two, where classic Moore's law has been starting to hit certain limits, we've had to get to more complicated processes. And in fact, this was associated with more integrated process systems. But however, the complexity was still fairly straightforward, so it could be done with changes on a few systems. As we enter era three, to enable further PPAC improvements, we're going to require the adoption of many more new and exotic materials. Furthermore, as these dimensions shrink, interfaces start to become a large part of the area of these materials, or the volume of these materials, and engineering of these interfaces and these materials becomes a key requirement. If in this era three, when you're talking about new materials, and for example, the one we are describing today, which is cobalt here for the transistor contact interconnect, we will see the need for the adoption of these integrated material solutions. And what I mean by this is it's not just the integration of a single new process, but a suite of processes that are required to assist the integration and adoption of these new materials. So that's what's different about this. This is the integrated material solution space to enable these new materials in era three. Moving to slide number seven. At Applied, we actually have a suite of very successful platforms that have been used in semiconductor manufacturing for many, many years. In fact, virtually every chip made today has been made on one of these platforms, and we can build on these platforms. So moving to slide number eight, we see that these platforms themselves have evolved in how they've been used. On the left-hand side is an example of the Endura platform that was typically used in era one and two, and these were fairly straightforward single-purpose systems, typically having one or at the most two kinds of chambers or technologies integrated on that high vacuum platform. But in era three, and as for example, in this example of cobalt-filled solution we described today, just on the Endura platform, it takes four unique processes, one ALD, two PVD, and one CVD process, all integrated under vacuum to reliably fill cobalt into these very small features. Slide number nine. So at Applied, actually, we have the largest set of material engineering capabilities available to use, and this is really important. Integrating these new materials is going to require different kinds of dry cleans, different kinds of depth technologies, PVD in some cases, CVD and ALD in other cases. It requires innovations in planarization and etching, wet clean, and in some cases, modification of these materials. Applied is uniquely positioned to solve these new integration problems and to bring these integrated material solutions to market. And this is going to be required really to get higher performance out of chips. So with that background, I want to talk about the metal today that we are introducing, or the new change today. And this is really the biggest change in the transistor contact interconnect, as I mentioned, in 20 years. So we're actually introducing cobalt as a metal solution, and this replaces, in certain cases, copper metal, and in other cases, tungsten metal that are used today in the logic space. Cobalt is being introduced because it has a low resistance at smaller dimensions. It has excellent ability to fill small features. It can actually work with much thinner barriers, and so it can have a larger volume in the available space. It actually also has improved reliability versus copper, and this happens to be a very big challenge to extending copper interconnects at small dimensions. And to cap it all, cobalt as a metal is fab-friendly. And what I mean by this is, you know, when the industry moved to copper about 20 years back as an interconnect metal, they had to go through a significant change in the protocol as copper, protocol required to handle copper. Copper is quite detrimental to the transistor, and copper diffuses quite easily into dielectrics as well. And so that was a major change. But unlike copper, which was, you know, fast moving, cobalt is quite benign and has, you know, for some time in the past been used in the front end or close to the transistor level. So it's a relatively easier change for the industry to adopt cobalt as a new metal. So I'm going to move to slide number 11 and show you where cobalt will be introduced. And this is about a 10-nanometer cross-section that you're seeing over here. And on the left-hand side, you'll see the layers marked. And so we've got the transistor contact. This is typically done with tungsten, and this makes contacts to the transistors. Above that, you have the various interconnect layers, typically done with copper. And we've marked all over there the M0 and M1, the two smallest copper interconnects, as you can see in the yellow text on the left-hand side. So at the 10-nanometer node, you have one layer of tungsten, and the rest are made with copper. At the 7-nanometer node, we expect we will see the adoption of cobalt, required to get better performance out of these transistors. And we'll see cobalt adopted at the transistor contact level, and as well as for one or two of the local interconnect levels, as you can see there. So I want to move to slide number 12 and give you some sense of what kind of impact we should expect to see from this cobalt transition. So the graph over here shows on the y-axis the conducting metal width, and on the x-axis the critical dimension, as you see over here. Tungsten requires, as you can see over here, tungsten is shown in the lower the lower figures, requires a pretty thick sleeve. This is shown in green. This is in the industry called the liner and the barrier. It requires quite a thick liner and barrier in order to fabricate a tungsten contact. And these liners and barriers are typically shrunk as small as they can get. And so when you need to shrink the critical dimension, the only place to shrink is actually the actual tungsten metal inside the contact. And the line over there shows the conducting metal width in those tungsten contacts, going down from 8 to 3 at the 15 nanometer critical dimension, and then essentially getting to 0 at the 12-nanometer critical dimension. Cobalt, on the other hand, can work with a much thinner sleeve, a much thinner liner and barrier. You can see, as denoted by the much thinner green line around the blue cobalt metal. And as a result, for the same critical dimension, has a much larger conducting volume. In fact, at a critical dimension of about 15 nanometer CD, which is approximately where the 7-nanometer transistor contacts are, there's a 3.7x increase in the conducting volume. And this should translate directly to a huge improvement in performance for that contact. And just to get my point across again, you know, you can think about this as a tungsten transistor contact as trying to drink your morning smoothie with a coffee stirrer straw versus cobalt, you know, going back to a regular straw. So, you know, certainly a much more satisfying situation. And, you know, for the semiconductor industry, a terribly important thing to try to extract performance from these transistors. Okay, moving to slide number 12, I'd like to explain why cobalt replaces copper. And it does so for different reasons. Now, it turns out that even copper local interconnects are starting to throttle performance for a transistor. And when dimensions are large, as you can see on the left-hand side, I have a graph on the left-hand side. When dimensions are larger, copper happens to have a lower resistance compared to cobalt. However, as these dimensions shrink, there is a crossover at which point cobalt has a lower resistance to copper. Now, this is kind of a little bit counterintuitive, but there's a good reason for this. And the reason for this has to do with how electrons move within metals. And we have an animation posted on the website if you'd like to review later. But in copper, electrons have a wide mean free path around 40 nanometer, which means that they move in a wider wave, bouncing inefficiently at the surface of these narrow lines. And this slows them down and creates higher resistance. In contrast, in cobalt, the electron mean free path is around 10 nanometers. And electrons essentially shuttle down the narrow line with fewer collisions with the surface, resulting in a lower resistance to the current flow. So this gives cobalt a lower resistance than copper at smaller dimensions. But again, if you need a pictorial, think of a 100-meter sprint between, you know, copper represented by a man who's had, more than a few drinks, finding a meandering path to the finish line, and cobalt, you know, represented by, say, maybe Usain Bolt, making a lightning-fast straight path to the finish line. Of course, the electrons going through cobalt are going to get there faster. There's one more reason for a difference, actually. As I mentioned earlier, cobalt can work with thinner barriers than copper. And as a result, the vertical resistance is also lower. So you can see on these two pictorials, the sleeve or the liners that are used to contain the copper metal are much thicker than the ones that are used to contain the cobalt metal. And as a result, the resistance through that contacting interface is much lower for cobalt. All of these makes replacing copper with cobalt sort of a requirement to unlock the full potential of transistors at these smaller dimensions. So with that background, I want to move to slide number 14 and just give you some numbers as to kind of what kind of improvement we'll see for cobalt, in this case for cobalt replacing tungsten for the transistor contact. And the graph shows the normalized transistor contact resistance on the left-hand side on the y-axis and compares tungsten and cobalt. As you can see, when you move from tungsten, which has a median normalized resistance of 8.59, the cobalt resistance for the same contact, and this happens to be a 15-nanometer contact hole, is about 1. So a huge reduction, an 87% reduction in the resistance. And this directly translates into the ability to extract power and performance out of these transistors. Also, if you notice, another very important point is the variability. You know, with the tungsten contacts, there's a very large variability. Again, this variability you can think of as affecting the speed of these devices, and essentially you're going to be as fast as the slowest device, and the improved variability again gives you better performance margin at these smaller dimensions. So with that, I want to move to slide number 15 and tell you something about how cobalt delivers performance improvements at a chip level. And we've done this a little simplistically, but we've done this using some EDA simulation tools. So before I say that, I just want to say, you know, to better judge the value of Cobalt, we've actually been using tools such as these EDA tools, EDA simulation tools, to figure out whether what kind of value we might get from these, kind of changes. And these are big changes we're making over here. So on the left-hand side, what you're looking at is a 5-transistor ring oscillator circuit setup. This compares the performance loss with the tungsten transistor contact with that of a cobalt transistor contact. And for simplicity, we've excluded the change in the metal M1 effects. For this purpose, we're just using copper. You know, this is part of our product development engine. This is the stuff Gary talks about in how we do new developments within the company. And it's our own internal systematic approach to developing new products. It's an excellent way for us to judge the value of a project, you know, especially something as significant a change as this, prior to making a major investment. So we see on the right-hand side that for every critical dimension that we've modeled here, cobalt has a higher performance, cobalt contact has a higher performance than the ring oscillator circuit with a tungsten transistor contact. In fact, the benefits of cobalt increase as these dimensions shrink and, you know, get up to 15% improvement relative to a tungsten contact. So a very significant improvement in chip performance as these dimensions shrink. So I want to move to slide number 16 and provide some explanation of how we do this. So this cobalt integration is enabled, or this process enabled through a variety of processes across multiple platforms and technologies that are available within Applied Materials. To begin with, we're using the Enduro platform to do a surface prep. And by the way, we have an animation. These are stills from the animation. There's an animation on the website you can look at. So we begin with the Enduro platform to do a clean titanium deposition, an ALD metal barrier, PVD cobalt as an anchor layer, and then CVD cobalt as a filling metal. Follow that up by an anneal that's done on the producer. This is the first time we are launching an anneal product on the producer. This anneal is done. The purpose of this anneal is to purify the film to help the cobalt metal flow into these small features, and to also help the cobalt grains grow large in order to get a low resistance. We follow that up with another PVD cobalt layer that's used to deposit a thick overburden to prepare the wafer for planarization. And then goes into a reflection LK prime tool to planarize, to CMP. And we've also developed special tools in the ProVision to analyze these features and to study the perfection of the fill and so on. So it utilizes, you know, four of our platforms and just a wide range of technologies to create this integrated metal solution. And I think at Applied, we are uniquely positioned to do this kind of work because it does take a very wide range of technologies in order to bring these new materials to the market. So with that, I'm sure you have some questions on what impact this has for us. So this next slide, slide number 17, shows a placemat chart of the change in the opportunity going from a 28-nanometer node typical chip to a 7-nanometer node typical chip. And as you can see on the left-hand side, on the 28-nanometer chip, there is a tungsten transistor contact layer. There's one of those. There's about 10 copper layers, and there's one aluminum layer on the right top of the chip. When we move to 7-nanometer, we anticipate about the tungsten layer at the transistor contact to go away. We anticipate about 1 to 3 layers of cobalt, about 11 to 13 layers of copper metallization, followed by the one layer of aluminum on the terminal layer. And the entire SAM would have increased about 2.7x. To give you some sense of how this, what this, some scale, Cobalt, in this case, on the placemat is modeled at about 1.5 layers of cobalt, and that represents about $100 million of opportunity, while the copper represents about a $500 million worth of opportunity. So with that, I want to summarize this presentation today. So we really think at Applied Materials, materials engineering is a way forward to meet to address the challenges with performance reductions with slowing Moore's law. And this is needed in order to meet some of the biggest challenges that and the opportunities created by this AI wave. At Applied Materials, we are uniquely positioned to deliver these integrated material solutions required to bring these new materials and structures to the market. We have, a proven set of platforms that can be easily adapted to provide these solutions, and we have the broadest portfolio of engineering technologies to enable these capabilities, basically. And with that, we are done with the presentation, and I'll pass it back to Mike.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks, Kevin, very much. So what we'll do now is we'll get ready to do the Q&A session, and I think what I'd like to do is just, quickly summarize from my perspective, to you. This is really about the product development engine. I think a number of you have heard us talk about that over the years. It's something that Gary brought into the company and that is, now used broadly throughout the company. What we've been showing you today is the product of 5 years of work. And so what it's really all about is you've got to use your technology expertise to anticipate inflections. And especially as the industry continues to try to shrink, it's getting hard. The materials that you are used to seeing, when you shrink them any further, they break down, they don't work, they slow things down, they get worse. And so what we really need to do if we're going to continue to shrink is we've got to shrink and change the materials, and that's our job. So what we are doing with the product development engine is we are anticipating these inflections. It takes a long time to address the solutions. This took 5 years, but that's what we do every day. When we talk about a roadmap that we have that's building, this is a great example. When we talk about earlier and deeper collaborations with our customers, that's exactly what's going on right now because the technology is getting so hard that there's two choices. Either the roadmap slows down or we go faster. So we're going to go faster. The idea of anticipating the inflections is that we want to be the first company that is there and ready to help our customers with a complete solution that can help them speed things to market. That's the goal. That's what you're seeing today. And we have two assets that really help us here. Number one, we mentioned these platforms. We don't often talk about them, but we have things like Endura and Producer. You will find these in every fab around the world. We've shipped around or over 5,000 of each of these. So every chip is made with these, and these have become not a single process system anymore. These are multi-process systems, and sometimes they're highly, highly integrated, not only inside the machine, but with other related steps. This is what it takes today to compete and to keep customers driving Moore's Law. So that's what we're doing. And I think the other thing that's really important is breadth. There was a time in the industry where doing one thing well was exactly what customers needed. It was what gave you success. We argue that we're in a industry environment now where breadth is what customers need. Breadth is what we can use to help customers to continue to push the roadmap as Moore's Law classic shrinking gets harder and harder. And so what you saw from Kevin on that one slide is the breadth that we have. You saw cleans technology. If you looked at the Gartner roadmap, you'd see that Applied is not in the cleans business, according to Gartner. You saw ALD technology on the producer platform. If you looked at Gartner data, you wouldn't see us in ALD technology. That's because we have these technologies. They typically have been characterized as PVD when they're shipped, but that's not what we have. So we have a much broader portfolio than people realize. We're integrating them in new ways, and we think that that's going to be increasingly differentiable for Applied Materials, and we think that as we go forward in the industry from these more simple eras of engineering to the more complex eras of engineering, that this is exactly the way forward. So we're really excited about this. We're excited to be working on something for 5 years and to be able to share it with you. And what we'd like to do now is just kind of pause, give things back to the operator, and see if anybody has any questions. If you have a question and you'd rather not share it, just send an email and we'll get back to you later. But if anybody has a question that they'd like to address on the call, now's a great time. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Again, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, that's star, then one. Our first question comes from the line of Atif Malik with Citigroup. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you guys for doing this. And on slide 17, you guys are showing how your SAM grows, moving from tungsten to cobalt. And my understanding is your position in tungsten is not as strong, so moving to cobalt definitely helps your opportunity. The question is, are there other ways than physical vapor deposition to put cobalt in the interconnects, like electroplating, or you think physical vapor deposition is the way to go to deposit cobalt? And then I have a follow-up.
Radhif, this is Kevin. So actually, you're right. There is multiple ways to deposit cobalt. Physical vapor deposition is one of the ways that we use. We also use CVD, chemical vapor deposition, to deposit cobalt. Another way that has been looked at in the industry is ECD as well. However, to enable these cobalt contacts and cobalt interconnects, we find that a combination of the PVD, the physical vapor deposition, and the chemical vapor deposition cobalt is essential. The physical vapor deposition cobalt is required in order to get good reliability because it helps to act as an anchor layer at the bottom of these features. The chemical vapor deposition CVD is required in order to get a nice conformal cobalt that can then be flowed and filled into the feature. And so these are really the primary ways to get your cobalt fill. There is, as I mentioned, also a third step, which we do a cobalt step at the very end as a overburden layer. Again, that can be done with PVD, or that might be done with ECD as well. That's a less critical step in the entire process.
Great. And then as a follow-up, in terms of the adoption of cobalt, is it across all foundries, logic makers, and also if you can talk about the memory makers when they can move to cobalt? And the reason I ask this question is one of the microprocessor companies is struggling with yields and because of the patching and applications, and is this going to be kind of a driver to kind of improve their yield performance or will slow them down? If you can just talk about the diversity of cobalt adoption across foundries and logic makers.
Sure. So if I can speak in general terms. I can speak to specific customers of how they might be doing in terms of yield and what might be solutions to that. But, yes, so as you saw, the cobalt is primarily being introduced as a performance enhancement. Where you need performance most is in these logic and foundry type of devices. So that's where you're going to see the adoption initially. But as with any new metal, you start the adoption starts one place and then it slowly migrates into other places. I mean, memory didn't move to copper interconnects for many, many years after logic adopted copper interconnect. It seemed a sort of an overkill, but today all memory customers use copper interconnects. That said, at this stage, the cold adoption is starting with logic foundry customers at sort of the 7-nanometer foundry node dimension size. That's where, as you saw, there's a huge performance incentive to move from tungsten to cobalt. Did that answer your question, Atif?
Yes, very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's great. And Atif, one other thing I'd mention is that I think that this approach that we have here, you're going to be hearing about this term more and more in the future, integrated material solutions. This is pretty new for us, and what you'll see is that this is not limited to what we're doing today with cobalt. It's going to be used in other areas as well, and a good example of that is going to be patterning, actually. And so we are, as a company growing in SADP, SAQP patterning, and we're anticipating the arrival of EUV technology, for example. And as we discussed at the ISS event in January, that lithography improvement does not by itself help to make the chips work. We're going to be moving increasingly to 3D structures, even in logic, that need to be aligned. And the scanner doesn't take care of the overlay problem by itself, as the customers have pointed out. And so what you need is materials-based self-alignment schemes, whereby we can create selective regions in the chip such that if the scanning is off a little bit on the layer that needs to connect to the layer below, we can actually make it such that the materials will make sure that that via lands exactly where it needs to be. That's an extraordinarily complex materials engineering feat. It involves many, many selective steps. It includes many, many CMPs, and in a single layer, we'll have 5 CMPs and a whole bunch of selective steps. So that's brand new technology. And to do that, we need to bring together about 5 different equipment types at Applied. So that's the kind of thing that going forward to help drive the roadmap together with EUV and other techniques is going to be necessary. So stay tuned for more of that.
Our next question comes from the line of Harlan Sur with JP Morgan. Your line is now open.
Morning. Thanks, Kevin and Mike, for hosting this very informative call. I believe that Intel is one of your major, who's one of your major customers, is already using cobalt approach for their first 2 interconnect layers at their 10-nanometer process node. So great to see the adoption here. I know you touched upon foundry, but based on what we know at the 7-nanometer nodes, I don't think any of the foundry suppliers are actually using cobalt as the M0 and M1 interconnect layers. So is this more of a kind of a 5-nanometer adoption curve for the foundries?
Yeah, so actually, we can't speak to what customers might be doing. However, as you have noted, there have been some public announcements by some of the logic foundry customers as to what they might be doing. And so I think we'll leave that out in that's what's out in the public domain. The actual approach that each customer might take would depend. Cobalt, as I mentioned, is kind of a replacement to conventional tungsten transistor contacts is sort of a slam dunk. There's a massive amount of gain to be achieved there, and so it's likely that's going to be the first place where you see adoption. And the benefit of it decreases as you go higher and higher up into the interconnect circuit. So then it's a matter of customers' design rules. And alternate technologies that might be available to address, loss or performance loss from resistance in these, say M1 and M0 and M1 interconnects as an example. In addition to that, we happen to have other technologies that we haven't, that we're not announcing basically, that are also improvements on the status quo basically of technologies that we use above. So it's possible cobalt may be one layer in some cases, maybe 3 layers in other cases. So it's all over the place, depending on the customer's device and the processor they happen to be using at that particular fab.
Great. Thanks for the insights there. And, you did a great job of highlighting the circuit performance benefits of moving to cobalt. Can you maybe just help us understand from a manufacturability perspective, right, metrics like process module throughput, defectivity, total cost per step of using cobalt process relative to, let's say, competing copper or tungsten process flows?
Sure. So from a manufacturability standpoint, so as I mentioned, cobalt essentially provides a much larger window for gap fill, and this is for basically getting a reliable contact that can shuttle a lot of electrons through it. So compared to tungsten, just given given how small these features have gotten and how limited the amount of tungsten metal is available in them. So if you have any variability in your transistor contact feature size, that's going to translate into a huge variability in the tungsten metal and an even more dramatic variability in the resistance. So cobalt, by giving you that much higher margin, essentially gives you that as an improvement in overall process margin, as one aspect of process margin. In terms of defectivity and so on and so forth, these are things that have been worked out to help with the adoption of cobalt. There are different kinds of defectivity for tungsten as for cobalt, but that's not a showstopper. In terms of the the cost of, or to give you a sense on the cost of the cobalt versus tungsten, cobalt is a more expensive process. It's about four times more expensive than the tungsten flow. But there is a, you know, we're not focused on that. We're focused on, you know, delivering value to our customers, and there's a huge performance benefit arising from these cobalt contacts.
And great, thank you.
Helen, if I can just add to that, you know, so, you know, you were talking about which customers are interested in cobalt today, with, you know, versus others. I think, you know, a really key point that's worth underscoring is that the node names really no longer reflect the physical reality of what the customer's design rules are. And so what you're going to see is that some customers are going to experience copper and tungsten hitting the wall before others do. And but over time, eventually, I think what you're going to see is that cobalt will be adopted by most customers as they continue to try to shrink. And for that reason, we have the Maydan Center in Sunnyvale, California. That's the 300-millimeter development fab for customer collaboration. And today, we have people living there full-time working on these future nodes. So that's where we're trying to get these problems sorted out and the roadmaps configured for the future.
Great. Thanks for the insights.
Our next question comes from the line of Timothy Arcuri with UBS. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Thanks much. Thank you for having this call. I had two questions. First of all, from a competition perspective, you know, the path to cobalt, I think has been pretty clear for maybe 4 years or so. You know, obviously Intel's led the charge, and even GlobalFoundries recently has made some public comments about using it. And I think you had Endura Volta for CVD cobalt out for a while, probably 3 or 4 years now. So my question is, do the competitors like Tel and Lam, do they offer the same type of cobalt solutions? Can you give us a little bit of kind of a competitive you know, update?
Thanks, Tim, for the question. So, yeah, we've been working on cobalt, as you mentioned, for quite a long time. In fact, we released a cobalt process in about 2012, if I remember correctly, the Volta Cobalt process, and that was for the cobalt liner application for copper. In other sense, it was just an enhancement to the conventional copper interconnect. So we've been in the cobalt business for a very long time, and actually, you know, we've started our development in cobalt started many, many, many years before that. So we've got the widest experience with cobalt, depositing cobalt with CVD, you know, understanding this material in terms of how it behaves, having, you know, a variety of processes, for example, the PVD processes, the physical vapor deposition processes, or the annealing processes, and also, you know, proprietary inspection processes we've developed to study these. So we've got the best process knowledge on how to develop new processes, develop new integration schemes, study the effectiveness of these, and to deliver a solution to our customers. So we are kind of well ahead of that for cobalt than any of our competitors. None of our competitors have a solution that comes anywhere close to what we have, and or, you know, in terms of creating the value that we create with this cobalt solution compared to what we have. So no competitor today, for example, has you know, a viable or a production-proven CVD cobalt solution, as an example, and that's also a critical component along with the physical vapor deposition cobalt, critical components of making this cobalt integration work.
Got it. Okay, and then just to follow up on slide number 17, can you help isolate cobalt in terms of what the actual expansion is of the SAM just from cobalt? I know that there's, as you mentioned, some, like, you know, e-beam solutions that are optimized for cobalt, but what is the expansion in the SAM that's specifically related to cobalt?
So actually, the what we showed over here is really the expansion in the SAM. So the numbers that we've shown here relate only to the deposition tools and the annealing tools, which are brand new process modules for the fab. The planarization tool is a new process on a proven system, and the inspection is also some modifications to our provision system. So the numbers that we're showing over here actually are the more conservative expansion numbers, not including the fact that the other layers are growing for a planarization and for inspection. So, you know, to give you some more information on that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the cobalt versus tungsten, it's about a 4x increase in the TAM for us, and the cobalt versus copper is about a, you know, just cobalt versus conventional copper is about a 3x increase in TAM.
Awesome. Yeah, and Tim, to put just some rough numbers to it, I mean, you know, if we thought about the 28-nanometer node and the 7-nanometer node, so what you see here is that the tungsten's going away. That's not our market, so that's okay. The cobalt's growing quite a bit. And if you think about the bar on the right, that area, that's well over $500 million of market for us in just those spaces. So, again, this is excluding the CMP, the inspection, the metal gate, you know, et cetera. And the cobalt portion is well over $100 million already, even though this is a new technology. And as you know, you know, because you've been watching this industry probably as long as anybody, once these things start, they have the tendency to proliferate. And so we think this will be a business that scales into the multiple hundreds of millions of dollars. And you probably also know that where these technologies are being combined, they're being combined on platforms that are very sticky in terms of their use by customers. And the technologies that we're hanging on these platforms in order to do this are what we refer to as our leadership products. So these are these products where we have very, very strong product positions and, you know, pretty darn good business.
Great, Mike. Thank you.
Let me offer one more clarification of that. So actually on tungsten, from a tungsten and composition standpoint, the business, as you know, on the logic side is split. And in some cases, we are replacing our own business with a more valuable business, and in other cases, we're actually replacing the competitor altogether.
Yeah, thanks, Tim, a lot. And, operator, if we have time for maybe one more question.
Our last question comes from the line of Edwin Mok with Needham & Company. Your line is now open. Mr. Mok, your line may be
unmuted. If you were there, we don't hear you.
Hey, sorry about it, guys. Right, so thanks for extremely helpful information on the presentation. First, I guess I should try to understand where the cobalt market is right now versus where would you think it go? As you mentioned, you know, cobalt has already been in the liner area for a while, right? How much adoption have we seen for that? And then as we make this transition from liner to actual doing metal M0 and M1, right? Are you kind of leveraging those positions that customers already adopt that into kind of growing that, or is it more just kind of greenfield for, you know, new customers? And I'll follow up. Thanks.
All right, Edwin, thanks for the question. So cobalt actually is very well integrated in the marketplace already for the copper interconnect application. As you've probably seen in customer announcements, that actually has been adopted by different customers at different times. The earliest adoption was probably at the 20-nanometer node on the foundry side, and there have been more recent announcements by other customers. So cobalt as a liner for the copper interconnect is very secure and well adopted. Now, again, cobalt as a liner for copper was sort of essential in order to extend the copper interconnect technology, both from a gap-fill standpoint, that is important for yield, as well as from a reliability standpoint because of electromigration issues with the conventional copper scheme. So cobalt is, on its own, as a liner in copper, has been a very successful business for us. And the other thing with that is that cobalt process is now at customers and well adopted and understood by customers, and they're very comfortable with that. So we're actually building on that cobalt technology to make this cobalt interconnect scheme over here, the cobalt contact scheme here. It's actually just a building up on those with additional processes to enable transistor contact and interconnect cobalt fill schemes.
Okay, great. That's helpful call. And then just a follow-up question on the annual process you guys highlight on the producer platform. Can you kind of give us a little call on that? Is it an RTP or even the second annual process, or is it a slower, like how slower annealing process?
Yeah, so then actually it's not an RTP. So, you know, because cobalt's being used in sort of a logic middle-of-line back-end scheme, thermal budgets are much lower. What it really is sort of a medium temperature process. What's critical is ambient. What's critical is the thermal treatment time temperature history, and that's what it's designed to do. So it's designed to really do a great job, with excellent footprint density, throughput, and performance in terms of annealing, purifying these cobalt films, growing these cobalt layer, cobalt crystals, and so on and so forth. Hopefully that answers your question.
Actually, that's a great call. Thank you.
Thanks, Edwin. And so I think what we'll do is we'll end the call. Before we do, I've been getting a couple of emails over the past couple of days about SemiCon West, so I thought I might just take a moment to summarize what we're doing. So what you've seen in past years is we've used the Monday, July 9th. We're actually going to, based on investor feedback, do Tuesday, July 10th. And we will be in San Francisco, not Santa Clara, this year. And here's what we're going to do. So I think we all know the new AI era is happening all around us. And what that means is we're having this data explosion, right? Data's growing 25% compound. But it's happening as Moore's Law is slowing. That's become evident over the past year, over the past few months. That's a new phenomenon in the industry. And so that creates a problem. It also creates an opportunity. And so what we're going to need in the industry going forward is we're going to need new computing architectures that can do not single-threaded performance increases, but orders of magnitude increases in data throughput for machine learning and data processing. And we're also going to need new devices and especially new materials, because the materials we've been using, they're not working anymore as we shrink. So what we're going to do at SemiCon West is we're going to have an investor breakfast at 8 o'clock, but then we are hosting with Semi a new event called the AI Design Forum. And the idea is to create the first event ever where we look at the whole ecosystem from the materials on the wafer all the way to the new systems and explain all of the pieces and how they're going to fit together and how the industry is going to collaborate to make this work, because it's going to take a lot of teamwork. What you're going to see is a lot of experts from academia and from industry. So you'll be seeing people from Stanford, from Berkeley, IBM, John Kelly, who's the head of research, Qualcomm, a gentleman who's there who formerly was at Microsoft doing this kind of work, another Microsoft speaker, Applied will be there. So all of these companies will be there. We'll also have a lot of experts, David Cantor, you may know, who used to be at Microprocessor Report, Jan Borodovsky, you may know, is one of the world's experts on lithography and what it takes to make EUV practical. Paolo Giorgini is going to be there. When he was at Intel, he was in charge of the 450-millimeter roadmap, which, as you know, has not materialized, but he's got a lot of ideas for where we're going from here. There'll be other companies as well that are, commercial companies. We also have startup companies. So Sentient is a company that's a startup that's going to do a bunch of edge devices. Cerberus is going to be there. They're going to talk about what they're doing in AI and how they're using silicon in some new ways. And then what I'm also very pleased about is that we're going to have a special event at around the lunch hour. We are going to celebrate the Turing Award that's been won by John Hennessy, who's from Stanford and now chairman of Alphabet, along with Dave Patterson, who's from Berkeley and now at Google Brain. And the two of them wrote the textbook that everybody has used over the decades in computing, and they've won the Turing Award for their work on RISC, the microprocessor design. So Dave Patterson will be there. John's traveling, but Dave will be there. He's going to do a fireside chat. The latest edition of their textbook has a new supplement on AI and accelerated computing, so we'll talk about that. He'll be interviewed by John Markoff, who you may know. He's the author who just wrote a big book on AI and has been a writer for the New York Times for 28 years. And then that will lead us to the Bulls and Bear panel. That will be a little different this year. Semi tells me that it will be a lot more, a little more systems-oriented, not just semi-cap. And that will be moderated this year by Don Clark. Many of you know Don. He was the Wall Street Journal reporter for many years, and he now writes for the New York Times. So that gives you a sense of the day. We realize that that's a big footprint on Tuesday. That's a big day. And so what we will certainly do, first of all, hopefully this is appealing to many of you. Number two, we will hang around. So we'll stay around for Wednesday at SemiCon West. If you would like to meet us with some of your clients. We'll make Wednesday a big day as well, and hopefully we don't absorb too much of your footprint and we make it a great event. So thank you for your interest today in today's topics. Thanks, Kevin Marias, and your team. We're really proud of what you've accomplished, and we know that the pipeline is deep, and this is just the beginning of change for us here. And we'd like to thank all of you for your continued interest in Applied Materials.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.